So today, we start a brand new sermon series, as Andy already alluded to. And if you're thinking, man, it feels like we just barely got back into Open Invitation. You're right. I agree. We barely just got back into it starting in January. And then Easter's really early this year, guys. It's the fifth Sunday of March. It's a unique Easter because it's on the fifth Sunday of the month. It's on March 31st. So if we're going to do things that are Easter Lent oriented, we kind of have to get started now. So we're going to pause Open Invitation, but we will pick it up again, I promise, after Easter and be in it for a couple more months until we get to the summer. Deal? It doesn't matter because I prepared this. So that's what we're doing. So this series is called Wounded Words, Jesus Speaks from the Cross. What we'll be unpacking together over the next several Sundays are the final seven words of Jesus, sometimes just called the seven final phrases of Jesus. These are the last utterances that Jesus makes while hanging on the cross just before his death. So we're going to be talking about his final words, and today we're going to be talking about how he, on the cross, speaks and says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." Final words are often meaningful words. Whether you speak them or hear them, final words tend to make a difference. I ran across a few famous last words from a few famous people this week. P.T. Barnum, the ever-popular circus legend, his final words were simply, "What were today's receipts?" Even to the end, he wanted to know, is business booming or not? Napoleon Bonaparte, is that how you say it with the French accent? Is that right? I don't know. Napoleon said, "Chief of the army," with his final breath, still holding on to that position of conquest that he had held for so long. Winston Churchill, you'd expect him to say something really mind-blowing and deep and inspiring, but instead his last words were, "I'm bored with it all." Interesting. But you find as people are followers of Jesus, a lot of times their final words are much more inspiring. For instance, Charles Spurgeon, one of the greatest preachers that's probably ever lived, his final words were simply, "Jesus died for me." And John Wesley, the founder of Methodism and a man who has given us such rich theology, he simply said with his last breath, "The best of all is God is with us." Last words matter. And Jesus' last words from the cross matter immensely. Now, I'm not trying to say they're the only thing or even the most important thing, but I think they have some extra gravity because of the context within which Jesus has given them to us. And today we see a very short prayer that's offered from the cross. And what we're going to read in Luke's gospel, it's the only place that we find it in the gospel accounts. The only spot is in Luke. So Luke 23, a few verses starting in verse 32. "Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. And when they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. And Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing.' And they divided up his clothes by casting lots." Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, before we dive into the particulars of that phrase today, I want to do a little bit of an umbrella general thing that's true for today and for the remainder of this series. I want us to remember and embrace that there is mystery at the cross, a tremendous amount of mystery inherent in what is happening at the crucifixion of Jesus at a deep level. Now, it is true, on a very basic surface level, it is easy to understand what is happening. We understand that Jesus, through his death on that cross, is dealing with the problem of sin. This is something that is widely accepted by Christians. What is Jesus doing on the cross? Jesus is dying because of the problem of sin. But the mechanics of how Jesus is dealing with that problem of sin for all people, in fact, for all creation, for all time, past, present, and future, and the theological foundation that requires this kind of solution to sin, well, those are concepts that are very deep and, to be honest, beyond our full ability to grasp. There's a lot of mystery in the depth of the cross that we will never fully be able to grab hold of. There's an entire section of theology devoted to this. It's called atonement theory. It's been a lot of devotion given to it since really the inception of Christianity, but really in the last 500 years or so, a lot has gone into what is happening on the cross at a deep, deep level. So I just want us to acknowledge with humility that there's a lot happening at a deep level at the cross that we will not ever fully be able to grasp. But when I say the mystery, I want to make sure you know we don't mean unknowable. That's not how we're using the word mystery. Not unknowable. It's just deeper than we can grasp. I'm reading a book. Actually, the book that inspired this series is by Stanley Hauerwas. It's called The Cross-Shattered Christ. It's a book that just follows these sayings of Jesus. And he says it better than I can. This is what he says. The word mystery does not name a puzzle that cannot be solved. Rather, mystery names that which we know, but the more we know, the more we're forced to rethink everything we think we know. I'm going to read that again because it's very important, but a little bit hard to follow the first time through. The word mystery is not about a puzzle we cannot solve. Mystery, rather, names that which we know, but the more that we know, the more we're forced to rethink everything we think that we know. He's not done. He goes on. To respect the mystery of the cross means that we are careful that our explanations do not attempt to make Jesus conform to our understandings of things. We cannot domesticate and tame the wildness of the God we worship as Christians. So the cross, at a very understandable level, Jesus is dealing with the sin of the world. But at a deep level, there's a lot of mystery going on under the surface. So here's my invitation for you and really for myself over these next several weeks. Can we be willing to learn, to unlearn, or to relearn as necessary as the Holy Spirit through the Scripture gives us guidance? To learn, to unlearn, or relearn some of the depth of what's happening at the crucifixion of Jesus. And today we start with the phrase, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." And I want to dig into this specific phrase by first of all looking at it through some different possible lenses. And what I mean by that is I want to ask two questions. Who are they and what are they doing? When Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing," who are they and what are they doing that would require forgiveness? And I hope through this lens to get little maybe examples of ways in which we need to be forgiven. So if you were coming to church today thinking, "Man, I haven't been really convicted in a while. I need that." Oh, sit tight. It's coming for you. It's coming in waves. Because as we look through these different lenses of who are they and what are they doing that needs forgiven, I think sometimes if we allow it, it'll kind of seep into our own hearts. Let's start with the people closest to Jesus. Is they the criminals, or maybe specifically that one criminal who's hanging next to Jesus, that criminal who in just a few short verses will insult Jesus and question his status as the Messiah because of his apparent inability to rescue from the cross? When he says, "Messiah, what kind of Messiah are you? If you're a Messiah, what? Save yourself and us." Maybe this is the they. And what is the they doing? How does it show us what we may need to be forgiven for? Well, plain and simple, we need forgiveness when we use our words to verbally attack and abuse others. Our words are powerful. And this man, for whatever reason, chooses with his final breaths to use words that are insulting and attacking of who Jesus is. What kind of Messiah are you? James chapter 3, verse 6 reminds us that our words can set the whole course of one's life on fire. That's powerful. I saw a graphic on social media this week. Actually, my wife shared it, and it takes it to this level. I love this. Remember, your words can plant gardens or burn whole forests down. I love that because our words are so powerful, and you can plant beauty with your words. Or, if you don't use your words wisely, you can burn whole forests to the ground. We need to seek forgiveness when, with our words, instead of choosing to plant beauty, we choose destruction. We also need forgiveness when we have self-centered expectations of others, able to only see how they can benefit us. This criminal on the cross, first of all, insults, "What kind of Messiah do you think you are?" But then he says, "Listen, if you are Messiah, save us. Save yourself and us." This criminal only sees Jesus as someone who, if he is who he says he is, which I don't think he is who he says he is, then there's a benefit for me. Get me down off of this cross. And we do this. We sometimes see other people, and the only or maybe primary thing we see is, well, how is this person beneficial for me? How does this person help me get to where I want to go? So maybe the they is the criminals, or maybe the they is the soldiers, the Roman soldiers who are literally nailing Jesus to the cross, the same perhaps Roman soldiers who also had a hand in beating Jesus earlier or flogging Jesus earlier, the ones who are going to divvy up his clothing. Maybe that's the they. The soldiers who are actually doing the dirty work. And listen, the cross is gruesome. Nailing to the cross, hanging there, the beatings. But this week, as I was reading the account, I really got stuck on the idea of them stripping Jesus of his clothes. There's a sense of you're trying to remove all humanity that you can when you strip someone of their clothing. Now, part of it is prophetic because there's a prophecy about this happening. That's really the main thing. But understand that in that Roman world, this is a normal part of what a soldier would do during a crucifixion. Most soldiers, unless they are generals, would not have been very well off. They probably were relatively poor. And clothing, or even chunks of cloth, those things were very, very valuable because that was a world in which mass production did not exist. Resources were limited for even making cloth. So at the foot of the cross, if there are pieces of Jesus' wardrobe that can be torn into equal parts and divided among them, they will do so. But then they get to his outer garment, his robe, his tunic, his coat, and they go, "Whoa, this one is special. This is one piece. Let's not tear this one up. It's way more valuable to leave it alone. Instead, let's cast lots." But man, how dehumanizing on top of everything else to be stripped of even the clothing that you have left. We need forgiveness when we act with violence toward one another, even if we say to ourselves that it is deserved. Because the average onlooker would watch this happening and go, "Well, Jesus deserves this. He must have done something that has caused him to be in this position." When we act with violence, maybe not physical, maybe it's verbal or social violence toward another person, and we tell ourselves, "Well, it's what they deserve. They've gotten themselves into this place." We need to seek forgiveness for that. We also need to seek forgiveness through this lens of the soldiers, for when we just say to ourselves, "We're just following orders," without any question or without any examination. There's a book that was written in the early 1990s by a guy named Christopher Browning. It's called Ordinary Men. And the subtitle is Reserve Police Battalion 101 and the Final Solution in Poland. It is an absolutely fascinating book. Now, I had to read it as a student at Malone in my undergrad for a history class, but I'm glad I did. It's disturbing, don't get me wrong, but it is fascinating to see what happens to this group of middle-aged men in Poland who eventually are assembled into what's happening with the Final Solution of the Holocaust, and these average, ordinary men end up being responsible for tens of thousands of deaths of Jewish people, either directly themselves or by putting them on train cars and sending them away to death camps. And when they were interviewed later, we find that they were telling themselves and other people what? "I'm just following orders. I'm just doing what's asked of me. There's nothing I can do. I'm just doing what's laid out in front of me by the people who have charge over me." How many times do we tell ourselves, I'm just doing what I have to do? Regardless of how I might feel about the consequences, these are the things that I have to do. So maybe it's the soldiers. We look through that lens and ask, what needs forgiven? Or maybe beyond that, it's the rulers. How about the Roman rulers? They're the ones who pronounced this sentence on Jesus to be executed. Or what about the Jewish leaders who pressured the Romans and stirred up the crowd in order to get Jesus crucified? Maybe that's the they. What are they doing that needs to be forgiven? Whether it's the Romans or whether it's the Jewish rulers and authorities. I think what it teaches us is that we need forgiveness when we use power to silence our adversaries or to attain or even maintain a sense of control, because that's exactly what's happening with the Romans, with the Jewish leaders. Jesus makes them quite nervous. Jesus might be starting a rebellion or a revolution, and they have the power to make sure that doesn't happen. They want the status quo, the way that they are able to have control. The Romans more so, but then the Jewish folks even and locally, they want to keep things as they are, and they will use the power that they have in order to make sure things stay the same. How many times in our lives do we do the same? This is not just a large-scale thing when you have like the status of a governor or something. I know none of you are governors. At least I don't think any of you are governors. If you are, I'd like to know about it. It sounds fascinating. But you probably don't have the kind of power of a governor, but in your personal relationships, if we're not careful, we will use whatever little levers of power and control we have to make sure things stay the same, so that however we are benefiting from things being the same stays put. That's what we see through this particular lens. So maybe it's the rulers. Or maybe, beyond that, maybe it's the crowd. This crowd that still surrounds the cross and has earlier screamed, chanted repeatedly for Jesus to be crucified. Even when Pilate says, "Listen, I can't find anything wrong," the crowd refuses to hear it and simply does what? Crucify him. Crucify him. Maybe that's the they that needs to be forgiven because they don't know what they're doing. It seems that Peter maybe thought this because when you get to Acts chapter 2 and he's preaching this Pentecost sermon, what does he say in chapter 2, verse 36? "Let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah." He's not talking to just a soldier or two or to a leader or two. All of Israel. I sometimes wonder how many people hearing that Pentecost sermon were the same people who were chanting for the crucifixion of Jesus. So what do we learn from this lens? We learn that we need forgiveness when we join with the crowd to scapegoat someone and feel that release that we get by othering some convenient victim. I went on a rabbit trail this week reading some philosophy. There's a philosopher, René Girard. He talks about the scapegoat mechanism and how it works within human cultures. And essentially what we do is we become part of a growing crowd that identifies this one different person or maybe even dangerous person, and we decide that person needs to be done away with. And then when we do away with that person, we feel this sense of release. Everything's better now. We are actually drawn together as a community. We see this happening with Jesus and the crucifixion. But guys, it happens on smaller scales, doesn't have to be physical doing away with. So junior high kids are the worst, right? I'm right about that. If you're a junior high kid in the room, deep apologies, but even you know, right? So I say that because this kind of mechanism, we see it even in the social relationships of junior high kids. They will pick that one kid who is different. And then the whole crowd just starts to agree that that's the different kid. And no, they may not do away with that kid physically, but socially, relationally, they do away with that kid. And everybody who's not that kid, man, they feel better. Because they're not on the outside. Even if we're not scapegoating like Jesus was scapegoated, we still do this. We still find a convenient other and we find a crowd to go along with us, or we join that crowd so that we can feel better. Yes, Jesus was a willing scapegoat in a divine plan that doesn't make better what happens when the crowd chants for his crucifixion. Maybe that's the crowd, the chanting, murderous crowd. Or maybe, I don't know, is it us? Is it you? Is it me? Are we the they that Jesus is referring to? And you might say, Pete, I wasn't even there. I know you weren't there. But then I read prophetic texts like Isaiah 53, and I think we actually have our answer. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. I read through that very familiar passage this week, and I got stuck on two of those words, our transgressions, our iniquities. We need forgiveness when we transgress the ways of living that God lays out. To transgress, the original Hebrew is connected to the idea of a rebellion. Every sinful act, word, or thought is a little miniature rebellion against our rightful king. The Latin that's translated there, transgress, just means to literally step across or to step beyond something. So not only is every sinful word, act, and deed a little mini rebellion, but God draws up these lines to guide and guard our lives, and what do? We step across them. We step beyond them. Reminds me, have you ever been hiking and seen a sign like this one that just says, please stay on the trail? Please stay on the trail. So junior high kids, I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to throw myself under the bus. When I was a junior high kid and I saw something like that, my youth pastors back in the day used to take us for like a 2 or 3 day camping trip to Cook's Forest, and we'd go on the trails and see signs like that, and it's like, challenge accepted. Stay on the trail. I'm a pioneer. I'm an adventurer. Now, sometimes that sign is there because they don't want you disturbing nature, but many times, do you know why they say stay on the trail? Because if you don't, you might die. There are dangerous things off the trail. Our God lays out for us a way to walk upon, but what do? We walk across it, or we walk beyond it, and we put ourselves in danger. Crushed for our iniquities. The original, the Latin, it traces back for that word, is it means unjust or unequal. When we treat each other with injustice or inequality, considering others less than we are. The original Hebrew actually can be translated as crooked or bent or twisted or distorted. See, when we sin against one another, we treat one another as if they are less than I am. And as a result, what happens to our relationships? They get bent, they get twisted, they get distorted. The picture you see on the screen is of the crooked forest in Poland. It consists of about 400 pine trees that literally grow like at a straight 90-degree angle out of the ground, and then for some reason then grow straight up in the air. We believe they are planted in like 1930, and no one knows why they grow like this, or why they have, because nothing else nearby grows like this. It's probably aliens. No one knows. There are so many theories out there about what happened and why they did this, but I love this visual, because this is what we do to our relationships when we treat each other with injustice or inequity. Our iniquities cause our relationships to get bent and twisted and distorted. And we need the offer of forgiveness that comes from Jesus. And this offer that he has for us, did you notice? Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. They do not know what they're doing. In the book, Hauerwas talks about how it seems that Jesus, doesn't understand that we, with a more modern understanding of responsibility, we only need forgiven for the things we know we've done wrong. Why would I need forgiven for something I don't even know that I did wrong? Well, we do. Whether we realize it or not, we had a really fascinating discussion in our ABF last week or the week before about the passage that talks about needing to give an account for all of the empty or idle words that we have spoken. That's a big list. That is a long list for many of us. And I got to thinking this week, what about all the empty and idle words that I don't even know that I have said? There are so many things that I don't even know I need forgiveness for, but I trust that I do need forgiveness for them. Father, forgive them, even if they don't know what they're doing. And notice, this is addressed to whom? To the Father. This shouldn't surprise us. There's a long pathway of prayer of Jesus in Luke's gospel. He's praying like all the time, so we shouldn't be surprised to see him doing it from the cross. And I want to bring up this point for a specific reason, because yes, there's a lot of mystery of what's happening at the crucifixion on the cross, but I want to make sure you know that any theory or understanding of what's happening that pits the Father against the Son, or drives a wedge between the Father and the Son, or suggests that a division between these two divine members of the eternal Trinity must exist, misses the point, or at least minimizes the point of this prayer, Jesus coming to the Father in oneness, saying, Father, forgive them. He goes to his Father, and Jesus intercedes for us. Again, not in opposition to the Father, but with the Father in opposition to the accuser. Go to Job chapter 1, read about the accuser of the brethren. That is the one that we need to worry about, because Jesus and the Father, they are united in seeking the reconciliation of humanity. The Bible shows us over and over that Jesus speaks with the Father on our behalf. Romans chapter 8 says that he's at the right hand of God interceding for us. 1 John chapter 2 says it this way, my dear children, I write this to you so that you will not sin, but if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. He is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not only for ours, but also for the sins of the whole world, an advocate with the Father. I am confident that before Jesus finished giving voice to the requests, the Father said, I already have. Before Jesus finished saying, Father, forgive them, the Father's heart was in full agreement with what was happening. And consider this, guys, this blows my mind. Our forgiveness was already fully dealt with within the eternal Trinitarian Godhead before it was ever dissected by a single theologian. It was done. It was dealt with. Before it was even offered to anyone and they had asked, what do you mean? It was done and dealt with. Father, forgive them even if they don't know what they're doing. And the last point I want to bring up today is that Jesus chooses this forgiveness at an incredible moment. He's not choosing forgiveness from a place of ease with the benefit of time and reflection to deliberate about the hurt and why and the how. No, he's doing it in the midst of the pain, right in the middle of it. I read an article this week. Duncan Pyle says it this way. At the pivotal moment of Jesus' ministry on earth, when he became all that is broken and harmful in the world in order to reconcile humanity to God, his instinct was to forgive, despite the anguish of becoming sin, something you and I will never be able to comprehend the depths of, and the terrible pain of physical torture. His heart remained soft in the face of his own creation mocking and despising him. His response was compassion. It's incredible. Look, we just need to get to the point where we can forgive when we have time and space to consider and reflect. This is like, we'll never do it perfectly like Jesus did. But while we celebrate the forgiveness Jesus offers, we also remember as Christians, we are followers of Jesus, and we reflect Jesus to the world in the relationships that we have. Scott McKnight puts it this way. Jesus struck a path that was marked by an aggressive, offensive act of forgiveness toward his enemies, knowing that love and grace melt more hard hearts than mob-like scapegoating acts to which we are all tempted. The enemy, our enemy, is the one who has wounded us, and enemy love seeks to heal those wounds. Two things I love about this quote. One, an aggressive, offensive act of forgiveness. I love that phrase. You never think of forgiveness being aggressive and offensive, but when you see Jesus on the cross, forgiving even his enemies, even those who are in his face doing him wrong. And then also the idea, what is it that has the greatest possibility of melting a hardened heart? It's not getting even. That's our instinct, though. Our instinct when we are harmed is to say, ooh, I am going to get even, and then like maybe a little more on top of that. But Jesus, in the midst of this tremendous suffering, he instead chooses love, grace, and mercy, knowing that those things will melt more hardened hearts than getting even ever could. So as we finish, let's think about and pray through some reflections together today. The first one, let's invite the Holy Spirit to carry us deeper into the mystery of the cross in the coming weeks as we unpack these final words of Jesus. Let's ask that our hearts would be softened to learn or to unlearn or to relearn as the Holy Spirit sees fit for each one of us. Secondly, which example of needing forgiveness resonated with you today? Which one of those lenses maybe sort of struck your heart? In what ways lately have you been stepping across or going beyond the way of life that God lays out? Or maybe have you bent or twisted or distorted any of your relationships recently and need to seek forgiveness? Or today, just take a moment in the silence to thank God for the unity within the Trinity when it comes to offering forgiveness to a fallen humanity. And lastly, ask God to reveal to you a way that you can genuinely and humbly display some kind of offensive act of forgiveness in the coming days or the coming weeks. So I'm going to stop talking, allow some silence to fill the room. I'm going to flip through these reflections again, and then we'll finish up in a moment with a word of prayer.